Can you take me back, way back to your first fight?
My first MMA fight.
No, I was thinking your first fight.
My fight?
Yeah, like with your sister or something.
Oh, God, I don't even remember. Me and my sister Jennifer are like 13 months apart, so I probably don't even remember the first one, but we do both have matching scars on our arms from when we were fighting as kids, and we had like one of those big old-fashioned stoves. We were in North Dakota, like the whole thing got hot, and we both fell on it. And we both had these giant scars on our arms. Not giant, I think they look kind of cool, but that was an early one that I remember.
You know, one of the things I like, I was thinking about the fights with your sisters, and I have little kids, and they just fight all the time, and you're like, I should harness this. I should do something with this. But your mom did, and she came up with some pretty awesome rules for having four daughters. Tell us the rules.
The rules was don't take anything out of people's hands. Don't hit anyone unless they hit you first. And no being naked at the dinner table. And what were the other rules?
The last was you couldn't eat anything bigger than your head.
Oh, yeah, you can't eat anything bigger than your head. Because I always wanted, like, those big, giant lollipops at Chuck E. Cheese's or, like the cotton candy. I love cotton candy when I was a kid. My mom would never let me get cotton candy. She'd be like, no, it's disgusting. It's bigger than your head. So, yeah.
So I'm curious, your second rule, the one that says you're only allowed to hit someone if that person hits you first, it seems like that became like a personal philosophy for you. And I was reading early on in your life, the way you dealt with bullies was following that rule.
I mean, yeah, my first day of school, my dad's advice to me wasn't like, you're going to be fine, everyone's going to love you. It wasn't that. He looked at me and said, Ronnie, if anyone hits you, hit him back.
How did that go?
Nobody hit me.
Now, eventually you had some bully run-ins. What'd you do about it?
Yeah, when I was like, it was more when I was older, like middle school age, I started getting bullied, and I didn't look like much. Like, I wore like those Gap super flare jeans and spaghetti straps with little glittery butterflies on them, and I just didn't walk with my head down. And so I think certain kids would mess with me and not expect a reaction back, and I was always taught, someone hits you, hit him back. And so this kid, this boy, like, tried, he, like, grabbed me by the throat, I remember, from front. And just as a reaction, I just threw him, like, decked around on the pavement. He snapped his head on the ground and, like, cut the back of his head open. And he was so embarrassed, he just went to class and didn't say anything. And the teacher realized that he was bleeding and sent him to the hospital.
That's your first TKO, right?
Yeah. I don't think he was knocked out. I just think he just laid there a little bit, like, what happened? And then, like, I remember some other girl ran from, like, the side of the yard and was like, that was amazing. I saw the whole thing. And then I was just like, I got to go to class. I just needed to leave the scene.
How did your mom react?
Well, she knows that I have, like, truthful Tourette's, and I wouldn't, you know, I have, like, My liar is broke. Like, my whatever it that produces lie, it broke a long time ago. So I told her what happened, and she was like, it's self-defense. And the school had this policy, like a zero fight tolerance policy. So regardless of who started it, both people got equally punished. So it just got to a point where if somebody started something with me, I figured, well, I'm like, well, now I'm already in trouble, so I might as well just finish the fight. And that's pretty much how it went until I got a reputation and nobody messed with me anymore.
Yeah, you need the rap, right, in school? Once you have the rap,
it's kind of like, yeah, it's kind of like jail. You know, you got to start a fight and get a couple and then they don't bother you
and
anymore.
No one's going to take your bread. Yeah, it's
no,
good.
No, yeah.
Now, your mom comes across as a serious badass in your book. I love her. Tell me about her. What's she like?
Well, she is a serious badass, actually. She's much more interesting than I am, for sure. But I don't know if she would ever write a book, but hers would definitely be much better than mine. And she's just the most motivated and indomitable person I've ever met in my entire life. And I lucked out a lot while having her as a mom, because she wasn't one of those parents who wanted to always be the good guy and wanted to always be best friends. She always wanted what was best for me, and that was it.
You know, there was a time, I love this story, you broke your foot, and your mom made you run laps on it anyway. It was like she was like unwittingly training you to be a professional athlete.
No, it was on purpose. I told her I wanted to win the Olympics, and she was like, well, guess what? If you break your toe on the day of the Olympics, you got to function, so you better learn that you can.
That's amazing. You know, of course, there's another figure in your life that has had great effect on you as well, but a different way, and that's your father, who died when you were young, and you reacted to that by starting judo, which you're, of course, very famous for. What was it at that time about judo that made you fall in love with it?
I think it was that there was no one way to do it. There, you know, when I was a swimmer, there was one way to do the breaststroke or one way to do the butterfly, and if you didn't do it like that, then you got disqualified. And in judo, it was like, here are a bunch of ideas for throws. However it works for you is going to be different how it works for anybody else, and you had your own style, and you could really be creative with it, and it had so much of a problem-solving aspect to it that swimming didn't. And it really, I loved it because I was so in the present moment that my mind didn't drift like it did when I swam.
That's amazing. You know, it seems the way you write about it and the way other people have written about judo, that it's kind of religious. Was it spiritual, at least for you, in a way, or was it just simple discipline?
Well, that's what separates martial arts from other sports, you know? Martial art come with a philosophy as well. It's a way of life. It's not just a way to compete or anything like that. And so, I try to live by the principles of judo as much as I can. And those are maximum efficiency, minimum effort, and mutual welfare and benefit.
Those are. I can see those being almost a religion. And you obviously took it very seriously because you advanced up the ranks of judo in an amazing fashion. By the time you were 16, you were in the U.S. Open. In fact, you were the youngest competitor on the team. By 17, you were in the Olympics. Yeah. What was that like? That must have been a lot of pressure.
The only pressure is what I put on myself. And I was the youngest competitor, so no one expected anything out of me. But I expected to shock the world and to be the first American to win the gold medal. And like that, I had this big, grand vision of what it was going to be, and it didn't end up that way. And I was kind of crushed by it.
What happened after that? So you went through the Olympics and all the training and all the work. You're 17, and you didn't win in the Olympics. How did you react?
I ate some chocolate, and I went to the Junior World Championships, and I crushed everybody because I was mad. Yeah, and I was still, like, young for the Junior Worlds. Think about that. That was, like, for under 21 years old, and I was 17, and it was the best performance I ever had. I won the finals in 4 seconds.
In 4 seconds?
4 seconds.
That's fantastic. Did the person run away, or what did you do?
No, it was just the second that I touched her, I threw her right away. It was a drop of Ochigari. And
wow.
Yeah, it was one of those moves that's like, if it's called an off-the-grip attack. So the second you touch them, you do it.
Boom. I love it. Now, This seemed like a tough time for you. I know when you got back from the Olympics, you write about you ran away from home, which seems odd. You'd think it'd be the other way around. You have the tough times and the sport makes you disciplined, but you ran away. That was surprised by that.
Yeah, well, I just got to a point where I really felt powerless in my own life, and I felt like every second of my day was dictated by somebody else, and
yeah.
I just had no say. You know, I just felt like I couldn't speak up, and communicating was a battle for me for a very long time, and even when I was able to speak, it was still a long journey before I was able to speak up.
Hmm. So you made it through, you ran away, you came back, you kept training, and it becomes 2008, and you are back in the Olympics now. And take me to that moment, because I just can't imagine, I know our listeners want to hear, what's it like when that medal's put around your neck after all that hard work?
You know, there's sometimes there aren't words for things, and it's hard to put that one into words. But I was much more proud of myself than I thought I would be for a bronze medal, that's for sure.
Yeah, there's nothing to scoff at, a bronze medal. What was the ceremony like? I know your mom did something special for you during that ceremony as well.
It wasn't during the ceremony. It was during the fight. It was right after I won the fight. My mom brought the flag that they put on my dad's coffin and waved it for me. So it was the first thing I saw when I looked up after I won.
What was it like?
But I wanted to bring it on the podium and wear it on the podium, but the Chinese wouldn't let me. They'd, like the commissioner or the people that were running it, they wouldn't allow me to bring my dad's flag with me. I wanted to wrap it around me as a receive my medal, but they said no.
So at this point, I mean, you have proven that you are certified. I don't know if they certify this, but you're a certified badass, right? I watched a fight during this time of you where you got your elbow dislocated and you still won the fight and you have an Olympic medal. Did your life just change overnight? Did you get on a Wheaties box? I mean, what happened afterwards?
After the Olympics?
Yeah.
Nothing, man. Nothing. After people only care about the Olympics 1 month out of every 4 years. In September, you're nothing to them. And I realized that when I got home and I had no work experience and no education and I was trying to get a job. And I remember I was the jobs that I got were bartending and cocktail waitressing. And I was bartending and I told the customer that I won Olympic medal. And he was like, oh, that's cool. I collect stamps. And that's all it is to people. It's just like a fun fact about you.
Did you stay in training? Or did you just go on a bender? I mean, how did you respond to that?
And the only training I did is I did like no-gi grappling just for fun, just to stay in shape because I don't know. I always had more fun doing that than actual judo. And so I'll go every once in a while. But, yeah, I became a vegan after Olympics. I was like vegan for 8 months. But there's not much vegan at a bar except for, you know, whiskey. So I pretty much, yeah, I was on my sweet potato fries and whiskey diet. And
I've been there. Yeah.
Yeah, I grappled every once in a while. And that was pretty much my life. And I was just trying to figure out, like, what is it that's going to make me happy because all these other things aren't working.
And then MMA entered your life. What happened?
Well, MMA didn't really enter my life. I feel like I entered it. It wasn't following me around anywhere. But, I mean, I'd be working at the bar, and I'd see MMA on TV, and I would actually watch it, analyze it, and I'd see mistakes people were making and opportunities that they were missing. And I would just be like, oh, yeah. I would just, you know, I would tell patrons at the bar, like, I could totally do that. I would beat any girl in the world doing that. And they're like, uh-huh, whatever. Because why should they believe me?
Right.
But it was really frustrating to know I was the best in the world and that no one believed me.
So what'd you do about it?
Well, I decided I had to find a way to convince everybody I was right. So I started training, and I decided to make that my new mission and goal and realize that I was so much happier and more motivated when I was on a mission to prove everyone wrong that thought that being a woman MMA fighter, I had no chance at a career or a future or anything. I was so much more motivated at proving that than meeting everyone's expectations and winning the Olympic gold that everyone thought I should have won.
You know, you when you got into MMA, when you started, I watched a bunch of those fights. Like, you dominated in there. You had a huge chip on your shoulder. You came in, your face was intense. There was no way you're gonna lose, was there?
No.
You knew there was no way.
It was me versus the world, and I was pissed off. And there was no way the world was going to pick on me anymore.
Let's talk about your first championship fight, when you got the championship. Tell us about that fight.
First championship fight, it was 20 days short of a year after my pro debut, because I made a deal with my mother that if I was going to do MMA, I was like, just give me 1 year. I'll win the world title, and I'll show you that I have a career. That there's a career in this. So I was in a hurry.
Because your mom hated it. Your mom didn't like MMA.
She thought it was a stupid idea. And she said, go to college and be an adult. What's wrong with you? So I was in a rush. My first year of fighting, I fought 6 times in my first year.
Wow.
And I was just. Every 2 months, I would fight, and I would just come out of there unscathed. I would walk in there, I would win in less than a minute, and walk out. I never had a fight go over a minute until I fought for the title, and I still finished that in the first round.
Damn.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about that because I think for listeners who don't know about it, I mean, your fights are like 16 seconds, 30 seconds, you know, 50 seconds. I mean, you would just dominate, and you dominate almost exclusively by doing exactly the same thing. Can you describe what it is you do, the arm hold? Because it's brilliant.
It's actually not exactly the same thing.
Uh-huh.
It's like telling a boxer that all they ever do is punch. Like, you always knock people out with a punch. It's always the same thing. It's all you ever do is punch people in the head. And to me, it's every single one is entirely different and unique. And if you watch it from a technical standpoint, every single time these girls come up with a different defense and I have a different answer. And actually, two of my last three fights have been knockouts.
Yeah, the knee, I still think about that knee and I'm afraid. That knee you gave last fight. Because I'm like, holy, that looked like it hurt. So she was not ready for that at all. She thought you were going for the arm. Boom.
Yeah, well, Sarah McMahon, she's Olympic silver medalist in wrestling and undefeated. Like, she was supposed to be, like, my biggest challenge and test, and I always rise to the level of my competition. So if I'm fighting someone at a higher level, that's when I'm at my absolute best. And I knew when I fought her, she was a wrestler, that she never had her back put against the cage,
right,
and she'd never been hit on the body.
Right.
And so if she's put in an uncomfortable situation, she's going to revert back to what's comfortable, and she's just going to wrestle. And so once I put her back on the cage, she started wrestling me, and so I was like, all right, you're not going to wrestle. I'm going to start throwing knees and elbows and other kinds of things, because she's so focused on the grappling side that she's not going to be paying attention to those other things. And the reason why that knee worked was because from that position I was in, it made more sense for me to throw my right knee. So she would have, if I threw my right knee, she would have been prepared for that. I wouldn't have dropped her. But instead, I actually lifted up her right arm to make space and need her right in the liver and dropped her on the spot.
It took you longer to explain that than actually the match took, because the match only took 16 seconds.
That match was actually a minute and six seconds.
Oh, a minute and six
seconds. But at the time, it was still the fastest women's knockout. And then I beat Alexis Davis in 16 seconds, and then that was the fastest women's knockout. But then after that was Catanzaro, and that broke the record for the fastest UFC title fight in history.
Wow, that's amazing. So you have dominated the MMA for female division. You ended up getting the championship. You're in movies. You're in The Expendables. You're famous. You have made it. So the pressure's off, right?
No, not at all. The pressure is more than ever before, because all those opportunities exist because I am the champion, not because I once was. And so every single time that I go out there and I put on the line, I stand to lose more and more and more, and the pressure's increasing every single time. But the thing is, I do better under pressure. Some people have to convince themselves, oh, it's just like every other fight, and try to like calm themselves and make them think it's not a big deal. But I need to think it's a big deal. And that's what makes me the most focused and at my best.
You know, it's interesting. You know, you're a top-tier athlete. I mean, probably pound for pound the best MMA fighter in the world. You're also beautiful. You also have an amazing body. What does it mean to be a sex symbol and a top athlete? Because there's something about that as a woman, I think, that has positive and negatives to that.
Well, 16-year-old me would have been very happy to hear that. But I think the positive is I'm put into a situation now where I can really affect change where I think is important. And I had serious body image issues for a very, very long time, and issues with food and all these sorts of things. And when I overcame that, I was really thinking, like, what can I do to help other girls in the same position? Because I know I'm not alone, but at the time I felt like I was alone. And there are certain things you could do, you know, like the Dove makes those commercials and all these other things, and all these things directed at women to try and give them a better body image. But I really felt like what affects the standard that women hold themselves to is what they perceive men want. And it's the men's magazines that really sets the standard, not the women's magazines. And so when I go and do shoots like Maxim or Sports Illustrated Swimsuit or stuff like that, I purposely shoot at the weight that I walk around at. So right now, talking to you, I could go and do a Maxim shoot right now and look exactly the same as I did, because a lot of these girls, they cut weight for these photo shoots the way that I cut weight for a competition. And I only weigh 135 for a few hours out of the year, and it's unrealistic. It's unhealthy. I can't stay at that weight. And to make people think that I look like that all the time, it's inaccurate. And any girl that would aspire to look like that all the time, it's unhealthy. And so I really try that to whenever I do these shoots that are more, you know, embracing femininity and that kind of standard, I try to reflect something healthy as opposed to what I assume people want to see, because I think that healthy bodies are beautiful and it seems to be received very well.
How How do you see, you know, there was this moment, I was looking at a photo of you at a weigh-in, and you were just, man, your tight bun in the back, you were focused, your face was really intense, muscles bulging, you know, thinned out for that fight. And behind you were two ring girls in bikinis and heels. And I thought, my God, that's so ironic. How do you feel about that system with the ring girls and the whole idea of how MMA and boxing, for that matter, use women?
I think it's actually pretty cool that we are setting up a situation where you have one woman who is a competitor and these other women who are there for looks, but the focus is entirely shifted away from them. I mean, it really shows that there's a difference between a job and a career. Those girls have a job and I have a career. And, you know, I've had plenty of jobs on my way to get a career. And some of those girls, like Brittany Palmer, I she's one of the ring girls I really love because she hustled. You know, she got a ring girl job and paid her way through art school. And now she's able to have a career as an artist and a painter. And she used that platform to get there. But, I mean, it really shows a contrast between what women really are aspiring to be. And that is someone who's there to be independent and to support themselves and do great things instead of just stand there and look pretty.
You are female MMA. Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. It started with you. At some point, someone's going to beat you.
It didn't start with me. It certainly didn't start with me.
Well, in a sense, it didn't. I mean, I know it literally didn't start with you, but it started with you in the fence that you put it on the map. And there's a lot banking on you in a business sense of your success for MMA and for ratings and for women. You have a lot of power because of that. Where do you want to take it? Where do you want to see it go before you retire?
I am not really thinking about where I want it to go in the short term. I mean, before I retire, I wanted to be entirely self-sustaining and not be dependent on me at all. And now that the UFC has added entirely another division, they added the women's 115-pound division. I mean, that division exists entirely separate from me. And I was so happy when I heard that. And I just want to be able to retire undefeated, hand my belt back to Dana, and come back to watch a fight a couple decades later and watch two women fight for that belt that I fought for the first time. You know, I want to see it survive me. I want to have some sort of legacy.
God, it's amazing. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Actually, I have a question for you. I'm not going to use for the interview, but I really want to ask you if you don't mind.
Sure.
When I grew up as a kid, I was raised by my grandmother, and she was into professional wrestling, and she used to take me to the matches. And she and I had a favorite wrestler, and it was Rowdy Roddy Piper, who I know
you're
named after. So can you tell, how would you get your name from Rowdy Roddy? I still love him, like, with all my heart.
Yeah, he's awesome. When, you know, I was coming to MMA, I was trying to think of fight names, and Rowdy was the first one I thought of. But because there was Roddy Piper, I was like, oh, well, you know, you can't just steal someone's name. And then Judo Gene LaBelle, who's, you know, my Uncle Gene, he taught Roddy Piper. He taught him a lot of wrestling, a lot of grappling, all these kinds of things. He was one of his students. And so the highest end, the club I was training at, Gene is one of the owners, and they were having a grand opening of a new location, and Roddy came, and I was about to go have my amateur debut, and I asked his permission. I was like, if I could use Rowdy, and he probably thought nothing of it. He was like, yeah, sure, kid, whatever, have fun with it. And now it turned into this huge thing, and I was just on his podcast with him the other day. We spoke for like over an hour, just having a grand old ball with
awesome.
our Rowdy convention. Yeah, he is just like the sweetest person.
You know, I really want to thank you for your book. I have a daughter. She just turned 8, and she, you know, I have a son who's 10, and he picks on her, and we're always starved to defend yourself, but, you know, my wife and I are pacifists. What are you going to do? Blah, blah, blah. In reading your book, it's challenged me to think about what she needs and what it is that can make her a more powerful woman than just what I think it should be or my wife thinks it should be. And I'm thinking a lot more about her physically and what it is that she needs to be. What do you think a young girl needs in this day and age to be able to really fully, truly be themselves?
I think they all need an outlet, some sort of an outlet, whether it's playing piano or painting or soccer or judo or jiu-jitsu or learning how to shoot a gun. I mean, it doesn't matter. They just need to find something instead of, you know, when I was growing up, it was like girls sit here and play with dolls yeah. and guys go over there and play soccer. And I was like, screw the ball, just screw the dolls. I'm going to play soccer. And that wasn't because anyone encouraged me to, but I think a lot more girls would if they were encouraged.
What would you say now to that guy, the stamp collecting guy, if you ran into him today at the bar? What would you say to him?
I don't know. I'd probably make a joke about it. Be like, how them stamps going?
I got $18 million in the bank. I'm super famous and I'm awesome. How's those stamps going? Yeah. It's
Well, I'll be like, you been to Easter Island yet? You know? Did you know that Easter Island, that's like one of their main sources of revenue, is selling stamps?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's like a really, really rare stamp because it's like a 6-mile island or something like that. So people go there for a stamp collecting.
You have enough money, actually, and fame to actually send him there to help change his life.
Right? Maybe I should.
Maybe you should like, do a
reverse
tip.
It's your lucky
tip.
Day, stamp man. You're going to Easter Island.
Thank you very, very much. I hope you had a fun interview with us. And thanks. And good luck in your I'm going to be watching you now, so I'm excited.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.